What we can do now is continue to put out the documents and the information that these people withheld from the American public. You're about to see a wave of transparency.
What do you mean?
Just give us about a week or two.
All right, that was Kash Patel, the director of the FBI, with Maria Bartiromo about 2 weeks ago. And so we are learning more and more and more about January the 6th. And one of the best reporters on that topic is Joseph Hanneman. He's an investigative reporter for The Blaze. And he's just uncovered yet another story that I have never heard. And part of that is because video is now being released that shows actions of police on just protesters, the Americans that went there on J6. But this particular story is very shocking, and you won't want to miss this discussion. But first, in 2022 in Washington, D.C., there was a really grisly discovery. There were five preemie babies found in the home of the director of a pro-abortion group. They could have lived. They were fully formed, and yet they were aborted. And so now many pro-life organizations are trying to get the Justice Department to prosecute a doctor and the people that helped do that. You know, abortion continues to make the news, and it's because it is such a horrific thing to think about a baby killed either by partial birth abortion or removed and then killed. And that's what's happening. It's still happening. The Biden administration did not prosecute that case. And so it's coming up again. You're going to be hearing about that. Well, that's why preborn really is the best solution to all of these abortion-related issues, because they try to get to the women in a most redemptive way by showing them photos of their little babies inside their womb. It's a very creative, redemptive, beautiful way of stopping abortion, because when the moms see that, they choose to save their babies. Most of them do. And so that's why I bring preborn to your attention every time I'm at this mic, because they deserve your support. And of course, they also, the other wonderful thing about preborn is that they tend to the spiritual condition of the mom and even the partner, the father, if he's around. And so they do great work, and that's why they deserve our support. If you haven't donated to preborn before, it's just $28 for one ultrasound. That's to provide one ultrasound. And of course, any multiple of that, any amount, is really welcome. But I wanted to give you an idea of what the minimum would be. That would be $28, would help save the life of one baby. And so if you'd like to do that, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Well, you can call us at 662-821-2040. You can write us at sandy@afr.net. You can listen to us on any podcast platform. Our home base is afr.net. That's AmericanFamilyRadio.net. But all other podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, whatever you like, Amazon, whatever you listen through, we are there. You can find us on social media, all the platforms. You can follow me on X and my Twitter handle. Isn't that lovely? I remember when they used to start saying that, I thought it was so funny. I could hardly bring myself to saying it. And now I'm saying it. It's at Sandy Rios Tweet. That's at Sandy Rios Tweet. All right. Well, this is really a gripping conversation. And I hope you'll stay tuned to today's edition and conversation with Joseph Hanneman on Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness. That we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
Everyone will panic. Everyone will react. Do not do that.
Back up! You know we don't want to do this. Back up!
You sound mean.
Hey! What are you doing?
Stand up!
All right. Sandy Rios with you. That's the dramatic sounds of what happened another place on January the 6th at the Capitol. And that's the sound during that period of time that that audio is from that video. You're hearing the voice of Mark Griffin saying, don't do that. Don't do that. Just no, settle down. Don't do that. And trying to reason with the policemen at the, they're standing at the fence. And something terrible happens in that moment that you probably haven't heard. Mark Griffin was terribly injured. And so I've asked Joe Hanneman to join me again this morning. Joe, of course, I think is the really has to be at the very top of the list on the knowledge of J6. He's been investigating this now since January the 6th. He's written, I think, 400 or 500 articles on it. And this article on Mark Griffin is fascinating. There are things in here that I don't think anyone has heard about. And so it warrants a discussion with Joe, and I've asked him to join us this morning. So, Joe, thank you for writing this article. By the way, it's published by The Blaze, for which he is an investigative reporter, and it's titled, it's an exclusive, Justice for Victims' Severe Injuries is Elusive After He Was Shot Point Blank by Police on January the 6th. And with that, Joseph, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, I'm going to take a sidebar before we jump into Mark's story. Because the last time you and I spoke, we talked about Ashley Babbitt, this lawsuit that's been brought by her husband, Aaron, against the government, really, for, I'm not sure what the name of the charges are, but the wrongful shooting and killing of her on January the 6th. Now, for any of you listening, if you want to hear the details, unbelievable details about that. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago. It's one of our podcasts from just about maybe 2 weeks ago, I'm thinking. So I would suggest you go back and listen to that. But there's an update on that lawsuit, isn't there, Joe? I mean, we talked about how the judge was, Judicial Watch is representing the Ashley Babbitt's family. But there's been something that's happened. So bring us an update, please.
Yeah, there's been a lot of drama because the former attorney who had represented Aaron Babbitt directly after January 6th he basically fired Aaron as a client, which you don't hear happening very often. And so he let Aaron go, and then Aaron hooked up with Judicial Watch. Well, now this former attorney has wanted to get in on the settlement. There is a settlement in principle. They have not released the details, but there's been about 6 months wasted in court with this attorney fighting to get money for work that he hasn't done. So they finally, after probably 6 hearings, reached an agreement on that, and it's going to be arbitrated by the D.C. Bar Association as to whether this fellow deserves any money out of that settlement. Judicial Watch is not taking a penny. Whenever it's announced, they are doing this representation pro bono. But this got delayed, and I said Judicial Watch was concerned that this might slow things down, if not derail the whole thing. So they finally have gotten past that. I expect in the next couple of weeks for Judicial Watch to announce exactly what the terms are of the settlement, and then move on from there. But it's been a long process. This lawsuit was filed in January of 2024, and I expected that it would probably go to trial, but they've found a very inhospitable climate, not surprising, in the judiciary and in the District of Columbia. So this is probably a wise move for them.
Yes. And as we discussed last time, they wanted to try this case, I think, in San Diego, which is where Aaron and Ashley were living. But the judge refused and, of course, brought it to the D.C. court, and the judge has been hostile. It's really an unbelievable story, and I, again, commend that prior podcast for you, those of you that are interested, and I know lots of you are, to find out what happened with that. Well, today we're talking about someone different. And honestly, Joe, I didn't know this story. I don't know. Does anybody know this story? Has Mark Griffin been able to really get the word out about what's happened to him prior to this article you've written?
Well, I covered him back in 2022 when I was at the Epoch Times. came across him almost by chance. He was making some comments on the end of an article that I had written, and he had chimed in about that he had been seriously wounded and shot with a crowd control munition, which I had not heard that story at all. So I did get in touch with him, and I wrote a long story about it at the time, but we did not know who fired this munition. You know, we knew it was a police officer, but at the time there was simply no video available. The courts have locked most of this stuff up under seal, and you know, even if you're a defendant, and they threaten you if you release any of the clips that are under seal, that the judge can jail you. And so, I mean, this is how this stuff got covered up for so long. And so we did follow his story, but I've been working on that quietly for the past two and a half years, and finally came across a piece of video in 2024 that proves who the shooter was. A Metropolitan Police Department sergeant named Frank Edwards, who was very busy that day firing his orange munition launcher at just about anything that moved. So we were able to piece that together, and Mark did take that video, and he was attempting to make that a part of his civil rights lawsuit against the police department. But D.C. judge has made it next to impossible for him to proceed on that, unfortunately.
Oh, that's all right. That's unbelievable, but typical. I always say, and I probably said with you before, at D.C., living, I lived in Northern Virginia, you know, just right by the Pentagon for many years. And going into D.C., it's like, it is really like a third world hostile territory. And that's where these people are having to operate. The honest people of America are trying to find justice from J6, from this horrible place in which the jury pool is tainted. And the judges just hate regular Americans. They just do. Okay, so this is where Mark finds himself. But just to be clear, Joe, when I've watched, of course, a lot of your documentaries and others too, and read a lot and have other J6 listeners and sources. And so to repeat to listeners, there was this period of time where the protesters made their way to the Capitol, and they were standing down. I'm not sure how to. It's like think of a castle where there's a big rise where people are standing. The police were up there, and the protesters, who were very peaceful in this like pool of people, singing, as I understand it, waving their flags and just completely peaceable. And then the police started shooting these fire bombs from that rise, upward rise. But this is not that, is it? This is a different place.
Well, it's the same place, but it's on a different side. What you're describing is the West Plaza of the Capitol. It's beneath what they call the inauguration stage. And there's a little outcropping where the president stands and takes the oath of office every 4 years. And so the police were standing in this little outcropping and looking down on this massive crowd that made its way after the security perimeter was breached probably 25 minutes before President Trump was finished speaking. And you were probably looking at 10 to 15,000 people that were out in surrounding the media tower. And they came up, and the police very quickly tried to establish a defensive line. And that's where Mark Griffin found himself, these bicycle racks that were spread across the plaza. And Mark was on the north side. On the south side of the plaza is where the first shots were fired at about 1:06 p.m. on January 6th. A protester named Joshua Black was shot in the left side of his face with a rubber bullet, and it just penetrated all the way through into his mouth and blew a big hole in his face, and he started bleeding profusely. And I always cite that as that's when the fuse was lit on January 6th, because a lot of people saw it, and the word spread across this massive crowd that they're shooting at us. And from there, you know, and we've got radio communications from Capitol Police. You can just hear it. They said, launch, launch, launch. take them out, was one of the commands, take them out. And so that's when they started lobbying incendiary flashbangs, various types of tear gas, and continued to fire rubber bullets and pepper balls, which explode on impact and release a cloud of tear gas around it. But that all started with a single shot to someone's face, and I don't know what the police, what they were thinking. You're not going to move a crowd like this, which was basically place bound. In the back, there's a 4 foot high wall, and in the front is the Capitol. There's really nowhere to go. So if you try to push people back, there's nowhere for them to go. And so all of these things did not do what these munitions are intended to do, which is to cause people to scatter. It did, like smacking a hornet's nest, is it made everybody furious.
Right. And you've got a bunch of people down there that are not cowards already. They're going to fight. They're fighters, or they wouldn't be there on January the 6th. And they further made their way to the Capitol. They weren't, I'm sure maybe some did go to make some mischief. But I think most of them, Joseph, from my understanding, really did go to try to just be present so that the Congress could know that people actually cared about this electoral vote count, and that people were there to represent the fact that they were concerned and they did want to make their presence stop that count, temporarily pause it so that we could examine some of the nefarious things we were hearing about what was happening in these states. So, and the other thing, I talked to Mike Waller the day after. You probably know who Mike is. He's his national security expert.
Yep.
He's a good friend of mine. So he was there on that day, and I talked to him the very next day. And he described to me what was happening. And one thing I won't forget, it's probably pretty basic, but he was saying so many people were pouring down toward the Capitol that the people, there was like a push, like a crowd push, like a surge. So the people could not, just practically speaking, can't back up. They can't, as you described, can't scatter. Can't, that doesn't help. They're just like sitting ducks as they were being shot by these, I'm not sure what to call them. I guess they were definitely guns. You said there were, I always heard flash bangs, that was the firebombs. I'm not sure what the proper term is that caused that guy's face to be shot out.
Well, that was, from what I could see, that was a rubber bullet that's fired out of a rifle. It basically used compressed air to project a, they call them kinetic impact projectiles, and so that's what punched through his face. But that was, you know, they used a lot of different types of crowd control munitions. Some were hand-tossed, like they're literally rubber grenades that are packed with hard plastic pellets, and when they explode, they let off some extreme heat and some very bright light, and sometimes they have a concussion to them, and it's designed to disorient people. Typically, that'd be used by a SWAT team trying to make entry into a home where there are people that they need to disable. So they were tossing those things in. They were also firing munition shells from these, you know, it looks like a sawed-off shotgun, these weapons, and they're colored orange, so I think so police can see, you know, that this is not what you would classify as a firearm, but they have tear gas in them. Some have hard plastic pellets in them. Some have, in the case of Mark Griffin, what they call rubber baton rounds. I mean, these are hard rubber, probably the diameter of a quarter, three of them packed into a shell, and that was aimed directly at his body.
Yeah, let's walk up to that. Let's walk up to that. First of all, let's go backwards. Mark Griffin's from Pennsylvania, and you have some pictures, great pictures in your article of him. He's just a regular guy. I think he drives a dump truck. Is that right?
Yes. Mark was an interesting presence. I mean, he felt it was part of his role to explain to the officers along the police line why he was there and that he wasn't there to hurt anybody, because he looked across the line at a lot of these young police officers, and he saw fear in their eyes, and he did not understand, why are they fearful? We're not here to hurt them. So he went up and down the line. He'd show them his driver's license. He took off his camel cap that he was wearing that had a copy of the Constitution printed on the inside of it. And so he was basically saying, you know, this is my birth certificate. You look at the point of the Constitution and say, you know, we have concerns about the election. Our legislature sent a letter to the Capitol saying, do not recognize the electors that were forwarded. We've just got a lot of questions. And I think generally the police were respectful of that. And so he did this for close to a half an hour. And the police line, of course, went back and forth as it was pushed. But he continued to do this,
I was just going to say, Joseph, that's interesting because on that video, the part that you have on your article, which is available, by the way, at The Blaze, it has his voice. We heard it a little bit if people had known what they were listening for. And he says, don't do that. Don't do that. We're not here to hurt you. He's just, you hear his voice doing that, affirming exactly what you're saying. So it's amazing to me that you have audio of that. You must have really put together a lot of different sources to get all that, right?
Well, it was primarily body cam, and we owe the Metropolitan Police Department a debt of gratitude for the fact that their officers wore body cameras that day, because we've probably learned more about what happened from those sources than from any other, including the security cameras from Capitol Police, which do not have sound on them. But there were lots of officers wearing body cameras around where Mark Griffin was, and you know, he was saying, look, you're going to cause a panic. Don't shoot these things into this crowd. You're going to cause a panic, and you're going to cause an explosion of anger. And, you know, he was very calm and going up and down, but you had some officers that were just really hyped up, and Sergeant Edwards was one of them. And he rushed up to the line with his munition launcher ready to go. I was able to, using the video, his own body cam, to see what he packed into his weapon. And it just said it was these rubber baton rounds. And you are never supposed to fire one of these weapons directly at the body, and certainly not from 3 feet away. These are typically designed to be fired no closer than 30 feet. Sometimes it's 30 yards, depending on the kind of weapon. They're supposed to skip them off the pavement. And so they'll ding against your shin and cause you to flee. It's called pain compliance. But, you know, this officer raised his launcher, and it was literally appeared to be 3 to 4 feet down and struck Mark in the femur, the left femur. And it split his femur literally in two. And he doubles over in pain. And before he's able to take a couple of steps, another officer reaches across the bicycle racks and sprays him in the face with pepper spray. You know, and
this is a direct spray. This is a direct spray. I mean, in the video, you can see him leaning over the fence and hooking around Mark's face, who's bent over in pain, and shooting him spraying him right in the face. I just want to emphasize that.
Yeah, it's like I described it in the article, is adding insult to injury, because it was also another point blank blast, and that just added to Mark's confusion. And you can see on the body cam him stumble away, you know, and he practically fell a couple times, and he did get some help, but and he hobbled somehow. I don't know how he did this. He hobbled all the way back, and I'm talking blocks away, to the tour bus that he came in from Pennsylvania, and with a bone that was literally split from top to bottom, and his leg was so swollen, at least this is his theory, that it made a splint of itself because it swelled so badly, And so he was not aware that his leg was broken, really, until he got back to Pennsylvania. He just knew that he was in horrific pain.
Let's, before we carry further with what happened to him, besides that, there was another officer who shot someone else that you have on the video. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, he was Inspector Robert Glover. He was the number one commander of Metropolitan Police Department forces on the west side of the Capitol. So he was what you would call the incident commander. And just before Mark was shot, Inspector Glover also came very quickly up to the police line at the bike racks, and he held his launcher up over his head. In fact, he was leaning against Sergeant Edwards, but at an extreme downward angle, and he fired and hit a man in the back of the leg. And this was a man who was not even facing the line. He was looking in a different direction. He was not doing anything. He was not being violent. And you can hear the shot go off, and this fellow just collapsed. I mean, we don't know who that man is, but I would be very surprised if he were not grievously injured as well. He stumbled to the ground, and he's helped away, and we lose sight of him. And what happened to him is a real cautionary tale. We don't know how many protesters were injured on January 6th by police munitions. People did not come forward, and they didn't admit to this. And when Mark talked to me back in 2022, he did it at his own risk. They could have easily come after him and said, we see you were at the Capitol, so we're going to prosecute you for trespassing and whatever else we decide to throw at you. And people were fearful of being prosecuted and being swatted by the FBI. So you did not see people come forward and say, hey, your use of force was excessive. I'm going to file a complaint. So you just didn't see that. So we may never know unless people start coming forward as they see publicity from these things and say, yeah, that happened to me too, and here's my story.
You know what this reminds me of, Joseph? The Benghazi incident, that was a real big deal for me, and I had a lot of, I was connected to a lot of people that were working on that issue. In fact, and so I don't know. Andy McCarthy was one of them at the time, and so they were uncovering all of these things. And we learned that besides the three special forces guys that were shot and killed, trying to fight, off the Islamists without any kind of help coming from our military, it was a horrible story. That there were dozens of people seriously wounded and injured who were in hospitals all around the D.C. area. But they made them sign non-disclosure agreements and not talk about being there or what happened to them. And that's never come out. I mean, I'm just saying this reminds me of that. It's like the residual effect of all of this stuff is really incomprehensible. So, all right. So back to Mark. He gets back to the boss. And then what did this do to his life situation, Joseph?
Well, he got back to Pennsylvania, and he, of course, went to the emergency room, and they took x-rays of his leg, and apparently they didn't look at them because they sent him home and with some painkillers and called him about an hour later and said, you've got to come back. Your leg's badly broken. So the doctors, I don't know if a radiologist hadn't taken the time to look at the films, but so he went back in there, and it took them, I believe, 2 days to figure out how they were going to put that bone back together. And you can see in the story, there's a long titanium plate that goes down the length of the femur, and I believe there were 14 screws that went into his bone. And it started basically a year of recovery from that trauma. And so he was out of work and, of course, required, I believe, at least three surgeries to repair all of this, and eventually they took all the hardware out. But the bills were over $200,000. Now Mark had decent insurance, so his share of that was relatively small, but still it was probably around $10,000. But, you know, he had to basically learn to walk again. And, you know, this is a fellow, he's an entrepreneur. He owns his own dump truck and, you know, he lives alone. And so he really had to hobble around that house by himself and you know, eventually made it back into his truck. But he's got just a massive scar down the back of his leg. And it's his reminder of January 6th.
All right, so he tried to bring accountability for that. I don't know the whole story here, Joe. Your article is excellent. I mean, you just are such a great reporter. But he did not get satisfaction because you were helping investigate. And as you said earlier, and I want to come back to that, you didn't know exactly who did it. There was no proof of what happened in that moment until recently, right?
Right. And his lawsuit, he did file a lawsuit in, I believe it was in 2024, but he did not know the names of the officers, and we didn't either. So they were listed in the lawsuit as John Doe's. Now, typically they do that when they don't know the names of police officers, but they replace those names with actual officers' names later, which they did in Mark's suit. Well, one of the judges in the D.C. District Court, the federal court, said, well, you can't do that. And you added his name after the statute of limitations had run out, so she dismissed Frank Edwards from the case. It seems like a legally questionable opinion by the judge, but Mark, his attorney, pretty much abandoned him, unfortunately, at that point, and he's been kind of out there wondering, gee, what am I going to do? And I found out from a couple other attorneys in the past week that he's out of luck. His timing to appeal her order has passed, so he's not going to be able to appeal that. And now, really, he's going to have to look to the U.S. Attorney's Office for justice, because this officer could certainly be charged with assault. That's a different timeline. There's a 5-year statute of limitations on that. And, you know, we'll see if I know when Ed Martin was the acting U.S. attorney, he expressed interest in looking at these kind of cases. It's the literal weaponization of the government, where the police, in these instances anyway, were using excessive force, they were acting recklessly, and they were causing injuries. So, you know, that's pretty much the only avenue Mark has left for any kind of justice, and that's not going to include any kind of a financial settlement for him.
You know, I don't understand why they can talk about a statute of limitations when not only the police departments, but also the government itself, Congress, would not release on all of those video. So how in the world can they be penalized that there's a statute of limitations when they did not have the evidence until recently? How can that be, Joseph?
Well, I think that would be one of the appeal points. If he had filed notice of appeal, that would be one of the avenues for it. Say, we didn't know who this was, and we had the police department, Metropolitan Police, refused, and they continue to refuse to release any body cam footage from that day. We were able to get it because there were people that were sharing this with news media through the discovery in their own criminal cases. There's no reason this stuff should be withheld. And in fact, the Department of Justice wasn't withholding that. It was coming from Metropolitan Police Department. But everything else continues to be under court seal, even though January 6th is ostensibly supposed to be a thing of the past with all of the pardons and case dismissals. But all of this stuff is still under court seal. Yeah. It's a giant blanket of secrecy. And in Mark's case, it made it impossible for him to know exactly who he was going to end up going after. And by the time, you know, I supplied him with the video that we found and able to identify who shot him, you know, the judge said, well, you're out of luck because this is past the 3-year statute of limitations. And so it's really a quite an example of injustice.
Boy, it is. Now, I've said before, but when bears repeating, that there were lots of different kinds of police there on that day. Law enforcement, I should put it that way. And there was Capitol Police, of course, and there were Metropolitan Police Department. Now, that's District of Columbia, right? That's the police for
yes.
District of Columbia. So, you know, not the friend of conservatives already. And I remember reading or talking to someone, Joseph, maybe you wrote this, I don't remember, but there was a whipping up of officers before that day, as I recall. I don't remember the details other than they just made it sound, they did whip them up into a frenzy. I don't know if it's every department, but some departments, and that thus the fear. And I think the inference is that they wanted them. It was part of this is my theory. It just looked like a part of the whole plan, the whole scheme to entrap these people that came to Washington and prove that they were insurrectionists. They had that narrative already in their heads on that day. So they were whipped into a frenzy. What do we know about Sergeant Frank Edwards? What do you know about him? Anything?
Well, the primary thing we know about him is that he was one of the most active in the use of crowd control munitions that day. Thanks to body cam, we were able to watch him across this giant police line across the West Plaza. I never fully counted how many times he fired his munition launcher, but it was a lot. And he admitted on one of his videos to another officer that his department went through 500 crowd control munition, you know, shells or grenades, units, basically, for lack of a better term, which is, I mean, that's a massive, massive number. And they are supposed to account for every single one of those, because when you unleash that kind of power, you are supposed to file a use of force report. And, you know, we filed Freedom of Information Act with the department. And in fact, today is the last deadline. They're supposed to return it, and they're not going to. They never do. They basically, their attitude is sue us. And, you know, most media do not have the resources to do that. Judicial Watch is about the only place that's able to wring these documents out of these departments. But, you know, the sad thing about this is there were cops who did their job that day honorably. Many of them were injured by their own departments by a tear gas that blew back in their faces because it was imprudently fired into 30-mile-an-hour winds, and these officers didn't have gas masks. They didn't have proper protection. And so they got caught up in this as well, and it just exacerbated on both sides of the line the kinds of damage that was done.
Yeah, I feel like both sides were just pawns in some big play. And I want to play something for you. I just think this is interesting. Cash Patel was interviewed by Brett Baer. You may have seen this. This was probably a week ago. And this is clip three. It'd just be interesting to sort of get your comments on this. Cash Patel, the head of the FBI, on Fox News. Clip three.
Quickly on Crossfire Hurricane. That is a continuing production. We have found material, and I'm the Crossfire Hurricane guy, that I didn't even know existed in FBI holdings.
So there's been held someplace else? Or
that's been stashed away in locations that people thought we wouldn't find it because we wouldn't know to look for it there. And as promised with my congressional partners, I'm working with Congress on constitutional oversight because that's what the American people deserve. And those documentations have been flowing to Congress nonstop on a rolling basis since that interview. But more importantly, people have had questions about January 6th and whether or not there were FBI sources, not agents, sources on the ground during January 6th. And I told you I would get you the definitive answer to that. And we have. And we are in the process, again, of working with our partners to divulge that information. And it is coming. And I will tell you this. The answer to that question will surprise and shock people because of what past FBI leaders have said about it.
All right, well, that's a little different, but it is relevant because the Cash is promising a wave of transparency. Do you see this more information about January 6th, even the FBI's involvement, helping people like Mark Griffin in any way?
Absolutely. You know, assuming that Kash Patel's words are matched up with actions, which, you know, he spoke previously with Maria Bartiromo about this same issue, and he basically said, give us a couple of weeks. Well, it's been more than a couple. We're going to be going on 3 weeks pretty soon. So we should be seeing something. My understanding is information has not made its way to Congress as of yet, but that could be happening at any point. And we start to learn how many agents, because the reports that were put together that with these ridiculously low numbers, and one Inspector General report said there were no FBI agents in the crowd. Now, we know that's not true because we've found a number of defendants have found them in various places on the grounds. And I think you're probably going to see a very large number, and I suspect that he's going to unmask, hundreds, not dozens, hundreds of informants and agents and, who are probably working with other three-letter agencies scattered across the crowd that probably were involved in nefarious things, including encouraging people to break things and go into the Capitol. We've got some of the proof of that on video, but we really have been waiting for somebody on the inside to turn around and show us, okay, here's what the files show. And the fact that there was a stash of evidence in Crossfire Hurricane, that's very disturbing, that basically a black hole where they can hide things. I'm hoping that when he sends things to Congress, and I really think the FBI needs to do more than send it to Congress, because I got to be honest with you, it doesn't leave me a lot of confidence with some of our legislators that are going, you know, that they're going to turn around and release it. And I think they need to put it out there and let the public see it. Don't say, oh, we're sending it to Congress. What good does that do? Congress is not investigating January 6th at the moment. You know, we're into June, and the House has not appointed a new January 6th investigative committee, dragging their feet, stonewalling, wasting time. And, you know, I hope, you know, Cash puts stuff out on a server where people can do their own due diligence and look through the video and look through the documents, because, you know, sadly, the few lawmakers that were working on this have been stymied. You know, you've got the White House now and both houses of Congress, and they're not doing anything. They're not advancing the ball at all on learning, you know, who planted the pipe bombs. Was the FBI involved in that?
Exactly. Well, that's what I think has happened. I think that's absolutely going to be the case when we find out. And of course, Dan Bongino and Cash are both saying we know, and we're going to release the information on the pipe bomber. But what do you think, Joseph? You're the one investigating. What do you suspect is going to be the answer to who did that? And just for people listening, those pipe bombs are placed the time that the I think the so-called riot was supposed to take place when everything was, I think, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and they were planted at the Democratic National Committee headquarters and the Republican National Committee headquarters, and it was a story that they could tell. I remember when that broke, Joseph. It seems like it broke before the riot began. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, these were ostensibly, if you believe the FBI, which I personally don't, but that they were planted at the DNC and the RNC on the 5th, you know, after dark on January 5th. And they were discovered the following day, the first at 12:40 p.m., and the DNC bomb was found at about 1:05 p.m. And the Secret Service, in the case of the DNC, had swept that property because the Vice President-elect Kamala Harris was in that building at the time. And so as their preparation for her visit, they swept the property. They didn't find any bomb. And they had bomb-sniffing dogs, and so they didn't find this pipe bomb sitting in a hedge right next to a bench, which is astounding to me because these dogs are trained to do that. These were not bombs. These were more like training devices, and the FBI has not been honest about that. We've had some good retired or former agents like Kyle Serafin, who worked on this case, come forward and say, no, we were briefed. We were told these were not operational bombs. They had enough gunpowder or whatever the propellant was in them that a dog would hit on it and the dog would find it. Yet that did not happen in either case. So I don't see how the FBI isn't involved in some way, shape, or form because they put this story out, and yet they haven't solved this crime after 4.5 years, which is astounding considering the kinds of cases the FBI has cracked over the years. I think we're going to have our imaginations absolutely blown away when we get all this information out of, hopefully, Cash releases all the information they have on the pipe bomber. And we'll learn the motivation, which did draw a massive amount of force away from the Capitol. We watched the response, all the squads that had to rush and set up bomb perimeters, and this happened exactly at the time that the first perimeter was being breached at the Capitol. Yeah. And that was not a coincidence. So
there's
some
coordination
that went on here, and we need to find out exactly who was pulling the strings.
Right. And I think also it set the narrative, because it's hard to imagine now, but I remember that day. I remember when the story broke, it sort of put a taint, like these people who came to D.C. en masse are here to cause trouble. Look what's happening. They've planted bombs. That's the inference. And that just kind of laid the groundwork for the insurrectionist narrative. So it's those are my words. We'll see what the facts are when Cashin releases that information. Well, Joe, is there anything that you would like to say about the Mark Griffin case before I say goodbye to you? Anything else we've left out?
No, I think we've covered it, and I hope people that are listening, if they know of folks that were injured that day by police munitions, it's safe to come forward now. They're not going to be prosecuted for it. And, those stories need to be told, because I mean, we know just anecdotally people that were burned in the face, people burned in the thighs, people's clothing set on fire, their hair set on fire, that there were a lot more injuries of people in the crowd. And nobody was keeping statistics on those. They've got all the stats on the police that were injured, but nobody's keeping statistics on people on the other side of the police lines that were injured.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're aimed to set the record straight. We'll just keep talking about it till justice happens. So we may be very old and gray, Joe, sitting on a porch somewhere talking about this in the future if it doesn't get solved soon. But the article is called Justice for Victims' Severe Injuries is Elusive After He Was Shot Point Blank by Police on January the 6th. That's the title. It's a detailed article. It's very good, written by Joe, and it's in The Blaze. And I highly recommend it to all of you. So Joseph Hanneman, investigative reporter for The Blaze, we thank you so much for your hard work. And thanks for joining us today. Hi, this is Sandy Rios. A lot of Christians would be shocked to learn they are personally profiting from abortion and pornography. It's unnerving to realize just how many companies and corporations are actively involved in unbiblical practices. To help cut through the red tape, there is a great option known as Timothy Plan. Timothy Plan is the pioneer in biblically responsible investing. Timothy Plan carefully filters out companies involved in practices Scripture tells us to avoid. We are in an all-out culture war. One powerful way to make a difference is to put our money where our values are. Please go to timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-846-7526. Discover how to be a biblically responsible investor.
Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus. To obtain a copy, visit timothyplan.com or call 800-846-7526. Read each prospectus carefully before investing.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
Did you know that since Roe v. Wade was passed, and that was back in 1973, over 66 million babies have been aborted in the United States. That's nearly one in five pregnancies terminated. With the abortion pill now available at local pharmacies and through the mail, a woman's bathroom now has become the scene of the crime. And that's where she tragically expels her child. We have to stop this. And you know how to do that. Preborn is a master at saving these babies and their moms. Go to preborn.com/Sandy and make your most generous donation. That's preborn.com/Sandy.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
I think from some of this stuff, when we go back and look at things like the pipe bomber case, the cocaine in the White House, January 6th, and Crossfire Hurricane, the prosecutorial decisions will lay at the Department of Justice, but we are rigorously investigating them, and I think we've developed some great leads. And I also think we're not going to wait for any blue ribbon commissions. That's up to Congress. If they want to do that, that's totally fine. They're a coordinate branch of government. But we've got answers coming on all these matters.
I can't wait. Could you? I can't wait. We have to know what really happened on that day, and accountability needs to be brought to the people that perpetrated this horrific event on January the 6th. I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Joseph today because, again, he's a wealth of knowledge, as you know. I'm going to keep in touch with him, and we will be doing bringing to you more information as time goes on. Well, I'm really grateful that you listened today, and, of course, we could not do what we do without the support of Timothy Plan, and they help you figure out how to put your money where your values are and discover, maybe for the first time ever, how to be a biblically responsible investor. Visit timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-TIM-PLAN. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.